The headlines. Israel threatens to intensify its attacks on the Gaza Strip as the death toll from its strikes on the besieged enclave rises to 56. The Israeli army says Palestinians have fired more than 1,000 rockets towards Israel since Monday evening. And Iran says the resumption of the voluntary implementation of additional protocol by Tehran depends on the removal of U.S. sanctions. Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Mews. Thanks for joining us. 21 more Gazans have lost their lives as Israel intensifies its aerial strikes on the besieged Palestinian coastal strip. The Israeli military says that it has pounded 500 targets in Gaza. Gaza's health ministry says 56 Palestinians, including 14 children and 5 women, have been killed since Monday. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says several of its top commanders were among those killed on Wednesday. Hamas has retaliated by firing hundreds of rockets toward Israeli cities, including Tel Aviv. The Israeli military has confirmed the death of one of its soldiers by anti-tank missile. The U.S. energy corporation Chevron says that it has shut down a natural gas platform off the Israeli coast. This after an energy pipeline was hit near Ashkelon. Israeli medics say that 6 people have been killed so far. Meanwhile, Hamas political bureau chief Ismail Haniyeh says the resistance front will remain steadfast in this fight against Israeli crimes.
If they want to escalate, the resistance is ready. If they want to stop, the resistance is ready. If they want to move their hand out of Jerusalem al-Quds, the resistance is ready. This is the message that we deliver to all the sides and to whoever is involved.
Haniyeh said Palestinians will never leave al-Quds alone and will continue to fight to protect the holy city from Israeli forces. Meanwhile, Israel's Minister of Military Affairs has vowed more attacks on the Gaza Strip to bring, quote, total long-term quiet before any truce. Benny Gantz was visiting the southern city of Ashkelon, which has been hit by a barrage of Palestinian rockets. The Israeli military says over 1,000 rockets have been fired from Gaza since Monday. Ashraf Shannon is a correspondent joining us from Gaza City to tell us about the current developments there. Ashraf, what are we looking at in terms of what is going on? Have we seen any attacks by Israel at this point?
Yes, Israel continues to pound areas in the Gaza Strip. So far, the Israeli onslaught has led to the killing of 56 Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, including 14 children, 5 women, an elderly man, and the injury of hundreds others. As well as the destruction of several buildings in the Gaza Strip. Israel has also warned the residential and office towers that they will soon be bombed. When something like this happened yesterday, the resistance factions fired hundreds of rockets towards the Israeli regime. Meanwhile, Palestinian resistance groups continue to fire retaliatory rockets towards the Israeli regime, as well as mortars at Israeli military posts in the east of the besieged enclave. The part of the strategy is also to fire rockets towards the Tamar natural gas platform off the coast of Ashkelon, northwest of the Gaza Strip, as they did yesterday when they hit a huge oil reservoir in the north of the enclave as well.
You know, when you had the Israel's Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, visiting Ashkelon, he said that, and I'm going to quote him, vowing more attacks to, quote, total long-term quiet before any truce. What types of reactions has that had in the Gaza Strip, especially from the Palestinian factions?
Well, the only reactions the Palestinian factions have made was through the spokesman person of the Islamic Jihad's military wing, the Al-Quds Brigades, Abu Hamza. He made the statements while mourning the death of three top military commanders of Hamas's military wing, and he said that the resistance factions in Gaza are prepared for this battle to last for months. And I believe this is a strong statement, a reaction to Gaza's threats against the Gaza Strip.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Ashraf Shanandar from Gaza City, many thanks. Israeli forces have attacked Palestinian protesters across the West Bank amid escalating tensions in the occupied territories. In Ramallah, Israeli troops fired tear gas to disperse the Palestinian protesters who hurled rocks and burnt fires. One Palestinian was killed in the clashes. Similar clashes happened in Nablus and several other cities across the occupied land. At least three people have so far been killed. The unrest comes as Israel is pushing ahead with a heavy-handed crackdown on Palestinians in Jerusalem al-Quds. The tensions escalated after Israeli troops launched a crackdown against Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque on Friday, which marked International Al-Quds Day. Palestinian writer and activist Jafar Aramini says Israel is committing crimes in the West Bank and Gaza with impunity.
If you're listening to the rhetorics coming out of Tel Aviv, Netanyahu, his Minister of Defense, his Chief of Security,
yes.
They're all threatening, and they say, we've just started. You see, they've got a taste for our blood, and when they have a lick, they want to drink. And as you said, 35 Palestinians killed. 12 of them are children. Why? Because Israel can do it with impunity. Mr. Macron of France asked Israel to take it easy when they're attacking Gaza. Not to stop, but to use proportionate force, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
What do you call proportionate, Mr. Macron? They have flattened Gaza three times in the last 10 years, and they're about to do the same.
Iran's President Hassan Rouhani has condemned Israeli violence against Palestinians in occupied Jerusalem al-Quds. Rouhani described the incidents at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound during the fasting month of Ramadan as bitter and ominous. He voiced Iran's support for Palestinians, urging them to keep up their resistance. The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, made similar remarks and hailed what he called the resistance of the Palestinian revolutionary youth. Iran's Prime Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif also slammed the Israeli violence.
The criminal actions of the Zionist regime that have intensified since the International Quds Day and the unprecedented events in the Al-Aqsa Mosque and in the occupied territories, as well as bombardment of Gaza, have created critical conditions in the region.
Zarif made the remarks upon his arrival to Syria for meetings with the country's officials over the latest developments in the region. Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal al-Maqdad also denounced what he called Israel's bloody acts. The office of Iraq's top Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, expressed strong support for the heroic resistance of the Palestinian nation. The United Nations, the Arab League, the African Union, and a group of other international organizations also reacted to the rising escalation of violence in Jerusalem al-Quds and the Gaza Strip. Yemenis have launched a fundraising campaign to support the Palestinian resistance. The campaign comes amid the escalated tensions between Palestinians and Israel in the occupied territories. Abdul Latif al-Wushali reports from the Yemeni capital, Sana'a.
Yemenis have launched a fundraising campaign to support the Palestinian resistance and its armed struggle against the Israeli aggression.
There is no difference between our battle in Yemen and the battle of our Palestinian brothers in the occupied territories against Israeli aggression. What happens in Palestine, Yemen, and Syria amounts to a conspiracy hatched by America, Britain, and Israel. So we should stand by each other under any condition.
Meanwhile, Yemen's Supreme Political Council held a press conference in which it denounced the Israeli planned forced expulsions of dozens of Palestinian families from their homes in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in Jerusalem al-Quds. It called on the Arab regimes to take real actions against the Israeli moves.
We congratulate our Palestinian brothers on their heroic operations against the Zionists. We believe that armed struggle is the only available option for Palestinians to regain their usurped lands. What was taken by force can only be retrieved by force. We also call on the Muslim world to prepare for the upcoming liberation battle.
Earlier, the leader of Yemen's Houthi Ansarullah movement, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, had urged all the Yemenis to fully support the oppressed people of Palestine. Yemen would work to raise money, he said, and will get prepared for any new development. As Israeli violations of international law continue, Yemenis are more and more vocal in expressing solidarity with their Palestinian brothers. They say they will fight alongside the Palestinians against the aggression. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
People have rallied in several cities across the world to condemn Israel's crackdown on Palestinian protesters in the West Bank and its aggression against the Gaza Strip.
I'm here in solidarity with the people of Palestine, who are obviously under brutal subjugation from the occupation and the pointless acts of terrorism perpetrated by the Israeli military.
In New York City, thousands of protesters gathered outside of the Israeli consulate. A similar gathering was held outside of the U.S. State Department in support of Palestinians. The protesters condemned Washington's silence on Israeli crimes. Meanwhile, protesters in the Turkish city of Istanbul held a rally in front of the Israeli consulate for a third night in a row. They called on Ankara to sever ties with Tel Aviv. In Kuwait City, demonstrators voiced their solidarity with beleaguered people in the Gaza Strip and against the eviction of Palestinians from their homes in a Jerusalem Al-Quds neighborhood. Marchers in central London called for an end to Israeli atrocities against Palestinians.
In the wake of the Israeli regime's attacks on Jerusalem al-Quds, pro-Palestinian demonstrators took over Downing Street in the British capital, London. The demonstrators even managed to clear out a small group of pro-Zionist demonstrators and chanted in solidarity with the Palestinian uprising against the occupation, sending a strong message of international solidarity.
Outrage is what's being voiced here on the streets of London today after Israel's assault on the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Jerusalem al-Quds, as well as the attacks and the eviction of Palestinians from their homes in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. On top of that as well, of course, people are voicing their frustration and condemnation of the British silence over the massacres committed in the Gaza Strip.
Now they're attacking the Gaza Strip as well. They're attacking the Al-Aqsa Mosque at a time when, in the middle of Ramadan, at the most holy time for the Muslim people. This is an acceleration of the general attacks on the Palestinians, and it's completely unacceptable.
Since 1917, the British government has supported the Zionist project in Palestine, the settler colonial project that expelled the Arab Palestinians from their land, and which to this day continues to deny them their basic human rights. And today, now we see Israel is continuing this and ramping it up and is now trying to expel people from Jerusalem, from East Jerusalem, which is occupied by Israel illegally.
Demonstrators also expressed their outrage over Britain's allowing for the production of weapons to be used by the Israeli military and the UK's historic support for Israel.
According to the arms trade treaty that Britain is a signatory on, they are legally obliged to assess whether the hardware that they're selling to another country is likely to be used for human rights violations. When following the 2014 war in Gaza, where you saw the massacre in Shaja'iyya, Britain, within weeks of it, Vince Cable, the business secretary, rubber-stamped the sales of millions of pounds of weaponry to Israel.
With the Gaza Strip under bombardment as the armed resistance fires rockets at Israel, the Palestinian people rise up throughout the occupied territories. This is whilst the international solidarity seems to now be stronger than ever. Robert and Lakesh, London.
Iran's top negotiator in Vienna talks on the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal has reiterated that Tehran will return to compliance with the accord only if U.S. sanctions are removed in a verifiable manner. Abbas Araghchi also said that the resumption of the voluntary implementation of additional protocol by Iran depends on the U.S. sanctions removal. In February, Iran halted its voluntary implementation of the additional protocol that allowed the International Atomic Energy Agency to carry out short-notice inspections of nuclear sites. Iran and the remaining signatories of the nuclear accord have been engaged in talks in the Austrian capital since early April. The U.S. Special Envoy for Iran is also present in Vienna, but there will be no talks between him and the Iranian team. Tehran has already warned that it will walk out of the talks if it finds them long and drawn out.
Iran and the remaining signatories to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action are continuing their talks in Vienna to save the nuclear agreement nearly 3 years after Washington's unilateral withdrawal in 2018. Press TV has learned that the United States is complicating the negotiations by insisting on keeping in place 500 anti-Iran sanctions, including in the 2015 nuclear deal, officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA. Informed sources say if kept in place, the sanctions on these 500 individuals and entities will prevent Iran from doing business with the rest of the world, which is in violation of Article 29 of the agreement. This is while Tehran has time and again reiterated that Washington has to take the first step towards reviving the nuclear deal by unconditionally removing all sanctions in a verifiable manner.
It has been the United States who left the JCPOA, who withdrew from the JCPOA. It is the United States who should come first, who should implement its obligations and lift all of its sanctions. And then Iran would verify, and after upon verification, Iran would restart its obligations in the JCPOA.
Tehran has also reiterated its calls that the United States has to remove not some, but all sanctions on the Islamic Republic.
Well, our position is quite clear. All sanctions should be lifted. All sanctions which are mentioned in the JCPOA, and any new sanctions imposed after the adoption day of the JCPOA, including everything during Trump administration. This is our position, is quite clear, and we are working to come to a conclusion which meet our demands on the sanctions lifting area.
The comments by Araghchi comes as the JCPOA has been in disarray since May 2018, when former U.S. President Donald Trump abandoned the deal and reimposed the anti-Iran sanctions that the JCPOA had removed. The Trump administration has also placed additional sanctions on Iran under other pretexts not related to Iran's nuclear energy program as part of its maximum pressure campaign.
The second day of registration for the potential candidates for Iran's upcoming presidential election is underway. The registration kicked off at the Interior Ministry building on Tuesday and will run until Saturday. Former President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and ex-oil minister Rostam Qasami were the most prominent figures to register on Wednesday. A series of other notable officials have so far handed over their documents at the ministry building. Those names include Said Mohammad, who previously served as the commander of a major construction base, and Hossein Dehghan, the former defense minister of President Hassan Rouhani's cabinet. Iranians will go to the polls on the 18th of June to choose a successor to the incumbent Rouhani. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight. U.S. President Joe Biden said on Monday, 10th of May, that the United States would disrupt and prosecute a criminal gang of hackers called DarkSide, which the FBI formerly blamed for the huge ransomware attack that has disrupted the flow of nearly half of the gasoline and jet fuel supplies to the east coast of the United States. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists David Sanger and Nicole Perroff. The piece is titled, FBI Identifies Group Behind Pipeline Hack. U.S. President Joe Biden said on Monday, 10th of May, that the United States would disrupt and prosecute a criminal gang of hackers called DarkSide, which the FBI formerly blamed for a huge ransomware attack that has disrupted the flow of nearly half of the gasoline and jet fuel supplies to the east coast of the United States. The FBI clearly concerned that the ransomware effort could spread, issued an emergency alert to electric utilities, gas suppliers, and other pipeline operators to be on the lookout for code like the kind that locked up Colonial Pipelines, a private firm that controls the major pipeline carrying gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel from the Texas Gulf Coast to the New York Harbor. The pipeline remained offline for a fourth day on Monday, 10th of May, as a preemptive measure to keep the malware that infected the company's computer networks from spreading to the control systems that run the pipeline. So far, the effects on gasoline and other energy supplies seem minimal, and Colonial said it hoped to have the pipeline running again by the end of this week. The cyber attack prompted emergency meetings at the White House all through the weekend as officials tried to understand whether the episode was purely a criminal act intended to lock up Colonial's computer networks unless it paid a large ransom, or was the work of Russia or another state that was using the criminal group covertly. So far, intelligence officials said all the indications are that it was simply an act of extortion by the group, which first began to deploy such ransomware last August and is believed to operate from Eastern Europe and possibly from Russia. There was some evidence, even in the group's own statements on Monday, that suggested the group had intended to simply extort money from the company and was surprised that it ended up cutting off the main gasoline and jet fuel supplies to the eastern seaboard of the United States. The cyber attack exposed the remarkable vulnerability of a key conduit for energy in the United States, as hackers become more brazen in taking on critical infrastructure like electrical grids, pipelines, hospitals, and water treatment facilities. The city governments of Atlanta, Georgia, and New Orleans, and in recent weeks, the Washington, D.C. Police Department have also been hit. The explosion of ransomware cases has been fueled by the rise of cyber insurance, which has made many companies and governments ripe targets for criminal gangs that believe their targets will pay, and of cryptocurrencies, which make extortion payments harder to trace. In this case, the ransomware was not directed at the control systems of the pipeline, federal officials and private investigators have said, but rather the back-office operations of Colonial Pipeline. Nonetheless, the fear of greater damage forced the company to shut down the system altogether, a move that drove home the huge vulnerabilities in the patched-together network that keeps gas stations, truck stops, and airports running, particularly in the east coast of the United States. A preliminary investigation showed poor security practices at Colonial Pipeline, according to federal and private officials familiar with the inquiry. The lapses, they said, most likely made the act of breaking into and locking up the company's systems fairly easy. Colonial Pipeline has not answered questions about what kind of investment it had made in protecting its computer networks, and refused to say whether it was paying the ransom. And the company appeared reluctant to let federal officials bolster its defenses. Right now, they have not asked for cyber support from the federal government. Anne Neuberger, the Deputy National Security Advisor for Cyber and Emergency Technology, told reporters at a briefing at the White House. Anne Neuberger declined to say whether the federal government would advise paying the ransom, noting that companies are often in a difficult position if their data is encrypted and they do not have backups and cannot recover the data. While Ms. Neuberger did not say so, that appears to be essentially what happened to Colonial Pipeline. President Joe Biden, who is expected to announce an executive order in the coming days to strengthen America's cyber defenses, said there was no evidence that the Russian government was behind the attack. But he said he planned to meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin soon. The two men are expected to hold their first summit next month, and he suggested Moscow bore some responsibility because DarkSide is believed to have roots in Russia, and the country provides a haven for cyber criminals. There are governments that turn a blind eye or affirmatively encourage these groups, and Russia is one of those countries, said Christopher Painter, the United States' former top cyber diplomat. Christopher Painter added, putting pressure on safe havens for these criminals has to be part of any solution. Colonial Pipelines feed large storage tanks up and down the east coast of the United States, and supplies seem plentiful, in part because of reduced traffic during the coronavirus pandemic. Colonial Pipelines issued a statement on Monday saying its goal was to substantially resume service by the end of this week, but the company cautioned that the process would take time. Elizabeth Sherwood Randall, Joe Biden's Homeland Security Advisor and a former Deputy Secretary of Energy in the Obama administration, said that the Energy Department was leading the federal response and had convened an oil and natural gas and electric sector utility partners to share details about the ransomware attack and discuss recommended measures to mitigate further incidents across the industry. Elizabeth Sherwood Randall noted that the federal government had relaxed rules for drivers who transport gasoline and jet fuel by truck in an effort to alleviate the effects. Right now, there is not a supply shortage, she said. We are preparing for multiple possible contingencies. But, Sherwood Randall said, the job of getting the pipeline back online belonged to Colonial Pipelines. To many officials who have struggled for years to protect the United States' critical infrastructure from cyber attacks, the only surprise about the events of the past few days is that they took so long to happen.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Inside Israel. It's getting ever so hard to marry in Israel. Many Israelis are not allowed to marry in Israel. Simply put, there is no civil marriage in Israel. Others simply opt to not have a religious marriage, marry outside of Israel. But now with the coronavirus pandemic, they cannot do that either.
All right, so now we're talking a lot about Jewish law as well and how that pertains to marriage. How do marriage and divorce laws work in Israel? Because it isn't only Jewish law here.
That's a great question. In most Western countries, the authority to judge matters relating to divorce is in the hands of the family court. But here in Israel, marriage and divorce are under the jurisdiction of both the rabbinical court and the family court. So the legal systems of both of these courts are authorized to take care of these matters regarding divorce. So unfortunately, where they overlap gets really murky.
In Israel, marriage can only be approved by religious rabbinate courts. Also, marriage must be based on the Jewish religion. However, not all Israelis, according to the chief rabbinate, are Jewish, including immigrants and converts, among others. This has been the case since 1947. The generations then understood. But now, the younger generations, and with the influx of Soviet immigrants, things are changing, and not necessarily for the better. Israelis who cannot marry are having a hard time leaving Israel to do so. In Israel, there are no marriage registrations for Israelis who opt for a non-religious ceremony or those turned away by the rabbinate. Usually, thousands of Israelis in Israel who cannot marry under religious Israeli law do so outside of Israel. But this year, the coronavirus pandemic has prevented many from doing so. In Israel, there is no such a thing as civil marriage or divorce. Israel allows marriages to be held only under religious law, banning those who cannot or will not comply with a rabbi's demands from marrying. This is because marriage and divorce, among others, are under the jurisdiction of the courts of the chief rabbinate in Israel. Ultimately, this entity gets to decide what or who is Jewish and what or who is not. Under the chief rabbinate's orders, converts, non-Jews, and immigrants cannot marry in Israel. Under Israeli law, marriage and divorce resides with religious authorities, but a growing number of couples have opted not to involve the rabbinate in their personal lives. The rabbinate is run by Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox Jews who abide by legislation held over from the days of Ottoman rule over pre-1948 Palestine. In 1947, David Ben-Gurion, later the first prime minister of Israel, and the religious parties, which many of them were there before the influx of the white Jewish European settlers, reached an agreement that included an understanding that matters of personal status in Israel, which included marriage, would continue to be determined by religious authorities. This arrangement has been termed the status quo agreement and has been maintained despite numerous changes of cabinets ever since.
Well, you see, Israel is not completely, Israel is not a theocracy, although religion has a very powerful role. It was envisioned in the early days of the state in 1948. It was envisioned as a liberal society, but because it is a Jewish state, because the religious minority in Israel was not ready to define it completely as a secular institution, So the rabbinate has a very important role in Israel. It is part of the government. So it's not a private affair of people. The rabbinate in Israel, like in many other countries in which religion plays a prominent role, Israeli rabbis are actually government officials. They get a salary from the government. They are like a bureaucrat of the state. So marriage, because it is a very important civic institution, it is run by religious people. That's the situation in Israel. You can marry without a rabbi, but your marriage is not exactly the same thing in terms of your relations with the government. So that's the situation. Well, what people used to do, those people who did not want to marry with a rabbi and did not want to have a religious marriage, the only option was to go and marry in civic religion outside of Israel. Usually people would go to Cyprus, and then somebody like a municipal official will marry them, because there are two mature people. They come and say, we want to marry, and then there is a civic agreement, and they can marry, and they can come back to Israel, and their marriage would be recognized as civic marriage. But now nobody can do that, or very few can do that, because nobody goes to Cyprus now. There is another option in Israel that people can marry, because you see, the Jewish marriage are defined in such a way that if you have your spouse you want to marry, the only thing you have to do is you have to stand with in the company of others who are witnesses and say that you are ready to marry this woman, and she is ready to marry you, and you basically have done the social ritual of marriage. You don't need a rabbi. But in Israel, in order to get all the benefits from the state as a married couple, you have to be registered in the rabbinate. But basically, you can marry your loved one, the person you love, without any problems. There are many people who marry without the official that a rabbi officiate the marriage. You can do that. These are not kind of, they are almost civic marriage, but they are not in the same status. So there is some vague boundaries between the different arrangement for marriage in Israel.
The rabbinate inside Israel is very powerful, very, very powerful. They don't let to bring other laws into the state of Israel, because from the beginning of the state of Israel, they made a deal with the Zionist states, with Ben Gurion, to have the power of marry the couples. And so they had an agreement when they founded this Zionist state. Even the Zionist state was not a religious state. They are mixing religion with Zionism. At the beginning, the Jewish religion, the religious Jews were against the Zionist state. The Zionist state was founded by non-religious Jews, So then it came a mixture between religious Jews that wanted to found these Zionist states, and they created a symbiosis between religion, Jewish religion, and Zionism and Zionist political ideas. But that's not the original Jewish religion, and it was not also the Zionist project. It is a mixture of both. Well, it could be if they have a government that doesn't include rabbis or rabbinical parties, I mean religious parties, like the Shas. If they have an election and they make a deal with all the parties that are not religious, they could make something to change the law.
Yes, we have that problem. This is it was in the beginning a small problem. It was a problem that some people can say this is not really happened, but today we know this is a big problem. I am a friend in a group in Israel of lawyers and professor in law, and this is what we do. We speak about that and we do some action to stop that. I don't think we can stop that now because it's so big, but maybe we can a little bit put the light on action that happened and put the woman outside over and over again all the time. I think now in Israel we stay in very bad situation. I think we go backward, and I think that a lot of people want to say this is like religion people that make that problem, but this is not only religion people, and it's not all of the religion people. This is a group of people that they have an interest, and this is what they want to do.
Currently, thousands of couples are not able to get married at all, since going abroad is not an option due to the coronavirus pandemic, and the chief rabbinate will not perform a ceremony and provide legal recognition. The rabbinate standards and interpretations in these matters are generally used by the Israeli Interior Ministry in registering marriages and divorces. This legislation is amenable to the rabbinic establishment only. Many Israelis find they are turned away by the rabbinical authorities on the basis of Jewish law. Among them come from families who have immigrated to Israel from former Soviet republics and cannot provide the rabbinate with a required proof of their Judaism. Throughout the decades, there have been attempts to change the law, one such way as allowing civil marriages to be held by foreign governments under embassy ground. This had been thwarted by religious political parties that have historically held the deciding vote in coalition cabinets in Israel. Long before the coronavirus pandemic, hundreds of thousands of Israelis found themselves searching for options that included travel abroad or entering contractual cohabitation agreements just to validate their love and desire for family. For many Israelis, it has been and remains unacceptable that a person who is a citizen of Israel, a productive and law-abiding member of society, still does not have the most basic right to marry in Israel. This is why many are now calling for full civil marriage in Israel, which does not require any contact with the rabbinate for those who do not want it.
Well, the official government personnel will not help them very much, because in Israel, in order, for example, a young couple get married, if they want to go and get, let's say, mortgage to buy their first home from the government, some kind of assistance, they would not be able to do that because they are not recognized as a married couple, okay? But for any practical purposes, they can be married. And there is a special status for people like that. For example, a man and a woman can live together, and they are, for all practical purposes, are married if they live together and they share their life. They don't need the official stamp. But if you need some official assistance from the government, for example, in questions of will and a question of inheritance and a question of buying a house and all that, so the government intervene and it says, no, if you want our support, the government support, you need to be married according to our rule. And our rule are religious rules. That's the situation in Israel. So to some extent, it is a very troubling situation. Many people don't like it. Many people don't want the rabbi intervene in their life. Because, for example, if you want to divorce later on, you have to do it with some agreement of the rabbinate. Well, the rabbinate is a very powerful institution, but you see, it is not, its power is not unlimited. It is quite limited, but they are very powerful. Why? Because they command and they control civic relations that people are so important for people, the question of marriage. Because you see, because Israel is defined as a Jewish state, Judaism has a very profound role in the political arrangement of the country. So the political parties, who are religious parties, in throughout the years, well, national system, but also in the religious sphere. So they are very powerful, but not unlimited force. The civil authorities also can limit their power. Yes, they can, but not, it is not a, depends on what issue. For example, we have in Israel the issue of a student, religious young people who study in religious institutions do not serve in the army. And many people resent that because they think that if you are a citizen, like everybody else, you have to pay taxes, you have to work, and you have to serve in the army like everybody else. In Israel, now it's quite a sizable minority of people who do not work and they study. And what they call that their studies is their work, because they study religious things. And the political parties who are religious parties defend this, their right not to serve in the army and not even to work, and that's especially a privilege for males, not so much for females. So there are many twists and many interesting things that have developed in Israel that were not that like that in Jewish communities before the state of Israel.
On social media, Israelis talk about fundamental issues. Ron Miretti says, as a Jew, this rabbinate bothers me. No one should be able to tell me I'm not Jewish enough. You want to continue to lose internal support? That's how you do it. Angry Dad says, Israel is now largely statutory, and there are specific laws putting family law matters, including matrimonial and divorce, in the jurisdiction of the rabbinate.
They have to go to another country, but I heard that it's a new news that the Norwegian from Norway government made a deal, a solution that they could marry by civil law in their embassy in Israel, so they don't have to travel to other countries to do that. that could be to Arabs, immigrants, not religious people, LGBT community, etc., etc. You know, this law in Israel, it's a mixture of secular law inherited by the British rule. The British inherited all the law except the marriages, the civil law for the marriages and the family law. So it is a mixture. It is not a theocratical law. It is not a democratically law. It is some mixture. So it has to be a solution to help all these people who want to marry and make some changes in this kind of mixture law between religious and secular judges.
Norway has offered to allow Israelis to get civil marriages at their embassy and consulate, as coronavirus restrictions have prevented them from traveling to Cyprus. Cyprus is a common destination for civil marriages. The issue is being debated, but it's not new. The concept of allowing Israelis to marry on foreign embassy grounds has been proposed before, but religious political parties did not allow it then. And now many believe that they will not allow it to happen, even in these distressful, uncertain times. This is why many in Israel despise the rabbinate. More and more Israelis are calling for its disbandment. Of course, that would be highly unlikely, as it is too powerful and it's essentially part of the Israeli regime. For now, Israelis just can't have a civil marriage.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.